From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Inmates killed five North Carolina prison workers in 2017. Four worked as correctional officers, one as a maintenance mechanic. Violent assaults on officers have increased significantly from previous years, according to the Associated Press. At Pasquotank Correctional Institution and Bertie Correctional Institution, where these deadly attacks took place, one quarter of the correctional officer positions were vacant. Last summer, 700 corrections officers had not received basic training. But according to a press release earlier this year from the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, only 25 of those 700 officers still lack that training. Are prisons more dangerous today than in the past? If they are, what's contributing to that trend? Some say it's due to poorly paid officers and too much overtime. Others identify higher concentrations of dangerous felons in cramped quarters as a problem, decreased education and job training programs, and psychological supports for inmates are also possible root causes for the increased violence. Professors Mario and Judy Paparosi have seen this cycle play out before. After working for about 30 years each in different prison systems, the Paparosis advocate for a correctional model, one that works on correcting and modeling appropriate behavior for prisoners rather than one based on a punitive paradigm. Mario Paparosi is currently the chair and a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of North Carolina, Pembroke. He spent 30 years at the New Jersey Department of Corrections, and he is a former chair of the New Jersey State Parole Board. Mario Paparosi, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having us here today.
Judy Paparosi is a lawyer, and she serves as a part-time professor also in UNC Pembroke's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. She has logged about 30 years working in the correctional system herself. Judy Paparosi, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for having us.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you or a family member been incarcerated? What was your experience with other inmates, with correctional officers? What do you think would help boost correctional officer and inmate safety? You can tell us about it by calling us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I want to start with a line from Fyodor Dostoevsky's House of the Dead, which was pulled out by our producer, Rachel Keith. And in this book, he writes, "The degree of civilization in a society is revealed by entering its prisons." Now, this comes from a Russian novel written in the 19th century, based on a Siberian prison camp. Mario Paparosi, is this a fair starting point?
I think it is, because you're speaking about how we think about people who have committed crimes and treating them as people or treating them as some other object that should be abused and punished forever. I often used to think, you know, if I was landing here from Mars and I stopped into a prison to look and see how we treated people, I would be thinking, my goodness, what do these people really think about their fellow human beings who have done bad things? I guess I'll sum up my comment on this by saying that in my view and the view of many people that I know, you can say that inmates are people first, and then they committed crimes. The rest of us are also people. And if we lined us up next to each other, we'd have many more things in common than we do dissimilar. And the way we act is that there are 99.9% bad things about the person who's an inmate and about us, the reverse. So I think it's important. And if you embrace that idea that people can change and inmates are people, then you would, I think, have a whole different paradigm for doing business in our criminal justice system.
And there's the rub. That sounds like a very compassionately based sort of worldview, philosophy. But Judy Paparosi, you have been a prosecuting attorney.
Yes, I have.
And so you certainly understand when families of victims would come forward and say, this convicted criminal raped my family member or murdered my family member. They've, as far as I'm concerned, they've forfeited their right to anything but the most harsh treatment.
Well, Mario and I luckily were invited to be involved with the victims' rights movement in New Jersey. But one of the things that we did, we were the only non-victims allowed in the original coalition of all the crime victims groups in New Jersey. One of the things that they allowed us to do was talk to them about how each individual inmate is different. We don't have to treat everybody like the person who murdered your son or raped your daughter. We don't have to treat everybody like that. Yes, there are some. I worked in prisons for 13 years before I became a prosecutor. So I had a very different perspective on putting people away. To me, to give a person a day in prison was punishment, amazing punishment, what could happen on that first day. Most of my prosecutor friends, and they were great friends, looked at it as, oh, I've got to give the maximum sentence. Whereas I would go in and say to the judge, well, it's a drug offense. He's got a drug problem. Why don't we go in with a treatment program? And the victims were so open to that because they don't want somebody coming out after many years in prison, as Dostoevsky described it perfectly, after many years in prison so hardened that they're going to kill someone else's child. And so believe it or not, we actually were able to partner very well as Mario with the parole and me being a prosecutor at that particular time to make the victims move and even understand mercy and justice go a long way. But there are some cases that are absolutely should stay in prison for the rest of his or her life. But those are the rarities. They're not the majority of the people in prison.
Well, tell us what can happen to a person in prison in a day. What are we talking about? Mario Paparossi.
It's a terrible place to be. I mean, just being sentenced to prison is, in fact, punishment. If people are looking for even more punishment than that, then I think you fall into the category of, you know, we don't treat these people like people at all. There's danger. If you're young, especially, there's danger. Or if you're old, there's more danger of being assaulted and things like that. There are gangs now in prison over the last 10, 15, 20 years that are becoming more prominent. So if you don't become a member of a gang or if you're a member of a different gang than the gang that you're encountering, you have major problems. But I'd like people to always think about what it means to go to prison. It's a dangerous place. You're not getting sentenced to death or to be beat up, which is a common occurrence. You're being sentenced to do time and to be corrected. And so I think that's lost on a lot of people, that prison is the punishment. It's also incapacitation, and it's also an opportunity to correct. And the corrections piece of it has never really gotten a fair shake in America or in many places in the world as well.
Both of you have said that you've seen this same cycle before. It seems to keep happening, where there's an increase in violence and then a harder look is taken at conditions inside the prison that we're saying in this discussion lead to the fomenting of that violence. And then programs are brought in and prisoners get more rights or they're treated better or there's more oversight, the changes are made. And then people look at that and say, why are we treating our prisoners so well? They did these horrible things. They deserve punishment, not a spa.
Do they deserve it forever? I mean, is that who we are as a people? If the answer to that is yes, and by the way, I wouldn't want to impose my view. That happens to be my view, that things are not forever. But I think our society needs to make a decision. Are you ever done paying your debt to society? Are you ever not an ex-con? Can you ever apply for a job and not have to put down that you were convicted of an offense somewhere? Where is the role of redemption in this process? We say ideologically, historically, that we are about corrections. We call them departments of corrections. Do we believe the path to corrections is to be mean-spirited and punitive throughout the entire experience? Or do we mean that we recognize that 95% of the people who go in will be shopping next to you in the supermarket someday and that you could be very well victimized by someone who was either not reformed or made worse by a system that did not take corrections seriously?
And that's one of the main pegs of your argument for the kind of prison reform that we're going to be talking about more, is that most of these people in the prison system will eventually not be in the prison system, Judy Paparossi.
That's right. If you think about a prison, you have to remember it is a society very different from the one that we live in. People don't live by rules. People think differently, and they're treated very harshly. So if we're going to treat an animal like that, by analogy, if we're going to treat an animal and all we do is beat him and have other inmates assault him or other dogs assault him, he's going to be a very dangerous dog. And what are we going to do? We're going to put him down. Our inmates are eventually going to get out. And I started in prisons in 1972, just post-Attica, and a lot of reforms, post the problems in Arkansas, a lot of reforms, and I was in New Mexico, which would eventually have a terrible riot. But I had the advantage of going, entering corrections at a time when the correctional system was trying to do better. And luckily, my college got involved. I went to college with inmates who had been on death row. And guess what? Not one of them went back to prison. They got off of death row because of Furman in 1972. They went to the college that I went to in Santa Fe. They graduated summa cum laude, top of our class, and not one of them ever went back. And yet that prison had the worst riot in 1980 because all those programs were taken out and hope was lost.
That was February 2nd and 3rd, 1980, maximum security prison. That is still considered one of the most violent prison riots in the history of the American correctional system. 33 inmates died. More than 200 were treated for injuries. What led to that?
Well, I have to put it in a nutshell because it's a major problem, but a couple of major things. One, these great programs that had started, there were a couple of escapes, like we're seeing in North Carolina. So what's the first thing a corrections official does? Let's make security better. So what? How can we make security better? Get all the women out. I was a female working in an all-male prison. Get all the female teachers out. Get rid of the programs that have any contact with the public. Get rid of any incentives for inmates. So what happens? You start losing hope. The inmates, very interesting in New Mexico, had a voice in the prison.
And I'm going to ask you to expand on that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're exploring the reasons behind the uptick in prison violence around the country and in the Carolinas. Mario and Judy Paparosi have worked in the correctional system for decades, now both teach at UNC Pembroke. We want to hear from you. Do you have experience in the system, either as an inmate or a worker? Tell us about it. 910-343-1138 or Coastline at whqr.org on this Wednesday. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're exploring the possible reasons behind the increase in violence in prisons around the country and in North and South Carolina. With us today, Mario Paparosi. He is a professor and the chair of UNC Pembroke's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. His wife, Judy Paparosi, is an adjunct professor in that same department and a lawyer. And they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. We especially want to hear from you if you have experience in the correctional system, either as an inmate or as a worker. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Judy Paparosi, just before we went to break, you were talking about that notorious prison riot in New Mexico in 1980 and some of the causes of that. And you said part of it, what happened was there's this kind of reactionary cycle that takes place.
Sure. In addition to the reactionary cycle was that mandatory sentencing had become a part of New Mexico's criminal justice code. And so we were experienced overcrowding. The prison was supposed to hold 1,200 men, and it ended up being double that. So our educational units were changed into dormitories for men. We had a lot of dormitories which were very unsafe.
When you say educational units, you're talking about classrooms?
Sure. We had ABE, GED, and college programs at the Penitentiary of New Mexico. And then they also had a snitch system. And a snitch system is very interesting because, yes, the corrections officers want to know the intelligence of the institution. But if you didn't snitch, they would put what they call a snitch jacket on you. So the inmates, even if they hadn't snitched, would be treated as snitched. So when the riot broke out in 1980, who did they go after first? The ones in protective custody that they assumed were either snitch or had been accused of child sexual offense. And so those are the ones that they targeted. And the brutality in that particular cell block floor, is worse than anything Stephen King has ever written about in his life. I mean, it's just the brutality was unbelievable. So much anger and so much violence within each inmate had pent up over those years. So easy to avoid. There's a lot of things you can do to avoid it, a riot like that.
You're listening to Coastline talking about prison reform in light of the recent uptick in prison violence. We're talking with Mario and Judy Paparosi. They both work in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at UNC Pembroke. Mario is the chair of that department. And we're taking your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Alexis from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you kindly. The gentleman spoke about how they seem to do time for life. Whether they're in prison or out, they have lost the right as a human being to exist without that ex-felon moniker. Last night, ironically, I housed two sex offenders. One has been with me almost 3 years, the other about 8 months. The one that's been with me 3 years has two jobs and just got a car about 2 months ago. I taught him how to drive. I'll not digress. The sheriff showed up at my house at 10 o'clock at night wanting to know if they were there. I haven't found anything in the statute so far that says that they can come to my property, bang on my door at 10 o'clock at night, and threaten them with warrants of arrest if they don't come to the door.
Well, Alexis, we'll ask our guests about that. But first, explain to us why you're housing these former...
Because they would be behind Food Lion in a tent camp. That's why. Because nobody seems to care. Mm-hmm. I've got the space. I've got my school loans and my twin daughter's school loans, and they have to get paid. They don't pay a lot. They pay based on what they get, which is very, very little.
So these two people are paying you rent?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Mario Paparosi, what do you say to Alexis's allegation about deputies coming to the house?
Deputies coming to the house would be a normal experience if you're convicted of a crime that's a sex offense. Whether or not...
Where is that a law? I want to read the statute that says they can come to my home, my property, and harass me. I've got a third tenant that has nothing to do with the criminal system.
Okay. Right. Well, Alexis, let's let...
is also affected.
Alexis, what you can do on that, and I'll just do it as a favor to you, contact me at the university and I'll try to look up the statute for you. But the issue is this. In our society, we've taken sex crimes and elevated them to the greatest level that we could elevate them to. I mean, you say sex offender, it's almost worse than saying murderer these days. And no one wants a sex offender living near them. We want them to register. We want them to be public noticed and so on and so forth. Whether we like that or not, that's a political decision. I just think that it's an unfortunate experience that we've made sex offenders have to be supervised for life, as opposed, I wonder why we haven't done that for murderers or aggravated assaulters.
Are there statistics? I mean, layperson question here, but are there statistics that sex offenders tend to have higher rates of recidivism than other crimes?
They tend to have lower rates of recidivism,
really?
Much lower rates of
so
recidivism.
So that is something of an urban legend or urban myth.
It is. It's just something that offends our psyche collectively, I would imagine. I mean, if you public noticed that a sex offender was moving into a neighborhood, it's not uncommon to have the town go crazy. I mean, as the chairman of the parole board, I used to have to go to town meetings. And I basically remember one time saying, look, if the person doesn't live in this motel and we keep moving the person around and they don't get any treatment, we'll have a nomadic tribe of sex offenders, as Alexis said, living in a tent behind a supermarket. How ridiculous is that? And that's common. I've seen documentaries. I'm sure you have too, your listeners on TV. But again, these are societal issues that speak to who we are when we make knee-jerk responses to a crime. We invent named laws because we want to show people we're doing something. That something we're doing probably is not what we should be doing from a cost perspective, from a public safety perspective, and I would add from a humane perspective.
Thank you so much for that call, Alexis. And of course, on this post, we will have your contact information at UNC Pembroke. So if
sure.
she wants to follow up on that question about the statute, she can certainly do that with you. We have Lee from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Lee. You're on the air.
Good day, Rachel. How you been? Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
My perspective dealing with corrections in the state of North Carolina. And like any other job, we always think we feel we're unemployed and don't feel we deserve of what we're working for. So that being said, the state of North Carolina needs to change their pay cycle first and foremost. These state employees get paid once a month, and that take a very heavy burden on people to want to work. They work 12 hours, 13 hours a day shift. And they do have days off, but when you get paid that once a month, you look at $1,500, $1,600, you're like, wow, I'm getting paid peanuts. Mm-hmm. But if they change the cycle to get paid twice a month, you know, that would make a big difference with people and make you want to come to work and feel, you know, you're already doing a thankless job as it is, and the circumstance that you're dealing with, you know, that population is very demanding. And, you know, the first, like I said, changing the pay cycle to twice a month, and that will help you with your money going a long ways and budgeting your money. Because when once you feel like you're getting $1,000 to $1,500 every week, compared to once a month, and you then feel like then that you're working, okay, I can do this. And that way you get top qualified applicants, because you know the applicants they've been hiring over the years, it's like you're picking any and everybody from off the street to come work in these facilities. And yes, it's about training, but it's about you having the wherewithal of what you're getting into. You put someone in these environments at 20, 21, 22, they're very gullible and naive, and they don't have a sense of what they're getting into.
Lee, do you feel like people who work as correctional officers are getting enough training here in North Carolina?
No, they're not, first and foremost. Because they go to training right at the Justin Academy in Salem Bird, North Carolina, for around about 4 weeks. And that little training is not hands-on experience, and which is not a good training to have. When you're dealing with people of different backgrounds that you have to deal with, when you walk into that building, when you walk into that place, and you know, and things that you're getting into, because this is like law enforcement and anything else. Correction officers wear different hats. And no, they're not equipped and not trained to do that type of work, do that, and then be in that type of environment. And it's very demanding at times.
Lee, you've raised a couple of really important issues here that I think both of our guests have identified as necessary pieces of this prison reform. Thank you so much for your call. Mario Paparosi, first of all, he's talking about just changing the flow of pay. In other words, same amount of money, but just meted out more frequently. Do you think that would help?
It may. I think it would be at the bottom of my list of priorities. But I think Lee also mentioned the amount of pay is critical, where I would focus some attention. But I would also say that the ability to apply for a corrections officer's job here in North Carolina and elsewhere should be upgraded to include different types of training and different types of educational skills, but most importantly, values. We rarely ask anybody when they're coming in the door, do you value the idea that people can be changed? Do you value the idea that even if they could be changed, that it's worth doing for somebody who did a bad thing? And if you can't get beyond that, and I would argue you cannot, and many people who we hire, not just in North Carolina, but I've seen the correctional system nationally and internationally, then it doesn't matter how many skills you have or how many degrees you have. I'll just quickly say that when I visited a prison in Singapore, I know we're not Singapore, but the corrections officers also did treatment.
Treatment? What kind of treatment?
Well, they did counseling. While they were guarding you, they were counseling you. They were running groups. They were doing little programs here and there.
So what you're saying is these correctional officers were invested directly invested.
Right. There was not a custody staff and a casework staff or a civilian staff. I'm going to let Judy comment more on that.
Well, all the prisons I worked in, it was always the us and them. So it was the inmates were the them, and the rest of us had to be us. And I remember when I first worked in the penitentiary in Mexico, they would say, stop shaking hands because every handshake's you're lingering. And I'm thinking, no, I'm trying to get to know the person's name. I'm trying to value him as a person. They could not relate to that at all, the corrections people. I happen to love corrections officers and I have tremendous respect for what they do. But they're not. They do only see themselves as police officers inside of a prison. And our police officers are meant to do one thing, arrest for crimes, prosecute for crimes, and so forth. But a corrections officer, listen to the name, corrections officer. I started when they called these places prisons and penitentiaries. But it has changed. We're talking about Lanesboro and Bertie, correctional facility. So but who's doing the corrections? Just the small treatment staff.
And Lee raised the point that a corrections officer is called upon to do many things. Not just one thing. It's a unique niche. It's enforcement and treatment. And you can do both if you have the right people.
Right.
And to get the right people, you need to have the right pay scale and you need to have the right training, etc. The paradigm is flawed at the foundation because unless we address that, we're not doing corrections and we're creating an environment that's going to be dangerous for people.
Our good friend Anonymous writes, I wholeheartedly agree with your guest's attitude towards corrections. The only reason I did not go to prison for the crimes I committed when I was young and dumb was one, luck, and two, the fact that I am white. Have we seen more problems in our prison system since they have become run by private for-profit corporations? Seems like capitalism will drive this industry to grow and produce more profits because that's what for-profit corporations do. What is the role of private prisons these days and the push for privatization?
Well, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, we've heard that we should privatize and get government out because government's not efficient and so on, whether it's prisons, medicine, or whatever. But in the case of prisons, I've visited private prisons. In my view, they're no better and no worse than state-run prisons. Why? Because people who work in departments of corrections create the specifications for the private sector to bid. So they're bidding on what we do.
And the model is the same.
The model is the same. And so often what you'll see is people complaining about a private prison. But in fact, in my view, they are no different than the public prisons, and both are flawed because of this foundational issue of having no hope. We've abolished discretionary parole. We have truth in sentencing where you're going to do your time no matter what, and when the clock hits a certain day, the door is going to mindlessly swing open and you're going to get released from prison whether you like it or not. So in my view, the argument about private versus public is a sidebar discussion that distracts from the fundamental issues that we should be concerned with.
North Carolina's new prison chief, Reuben Young, told the Raleigh News and Observer that if the prison system doesn't return people to the community better than they found them when they came in, then the system is failing not only the inmates, but the community at large, which his department is charged with keeping safe and secure. And I think both of you have made that same observation. Does the fact that this is the new prison chief in North Carolina give you hope in terms of evolving thinking about this?
I know for me, I'm so happy to hear that. I know the public thinks that public safety is guaranteed if we lock the door and throw away the key. They really do believe that. But as we've said on this program earlier, that these inmates are all going to come out. So if this man, thank the Lord, has this attitude of we need to send them out better than we found him, he has not only a fight in the correction system, but he also has a fight in the legislature. Because the legislature, during the just desserts period, when everybody was going to get mandatory sentencing and they got rid of parole in many states, they want to lock the door and throw away the key. You can't do that. Just think about a guy comes into prison and he knows he's got to do 10 years out of his 12-year sentence. Why bother going to a program? Why bother going to school? Why bother bettering yourself? Because you're not going to go any further. But if that same person comes in and says, I have a 12-year sentence, but I can work it down to 3 or 4 years and get out on discretionary parole, but I'll get my GED, maybe I'll do some college classes, maybe I'll learn a trade. What inmate would you rather have coming into your community? The guy that's done so many years that he's just so angry at the world, or the guy who thinks there's hope not only in prison but in the society that he's returning to? I would prefer the first guy. I mean, the second guy, the guy who has hope.
And just a few minutes before we go to break, but John from Ogden, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Rachel. I'm a volunteer for Kairos Prison Ministries International. That program is in about 500 prisons across the country and 17 or 18 in North Carolina. And studies have shown that this program reduces recidivism by about a third. The problem we're having in North Carolina with trying to expand it into other prisons is that some years ago the North Carolina legislature decided to eliminate chaplains at medium security prisons. And without chaplains there, there's no one really to sponsor and support our ministry. We go into the prison twice a year for a 3.5-day weekend. It's a Christian weekend. We're upfront with everybody about that. And then we go back to these prisons usually twice a month to meet with these guys. We're not a drive-by ministry. But again, you know, the problem that we face is that there are no chaplains. And I can't help but question the wisdom of this decision on the part of the legislature, because a chaplain in a prison doesn't make a heck of a lot of money. We do know that in North Carolina, takes about $30,000 to $35,000 a year to house a prisoner. And you think to yourself, gee, if that chaplain every year was somehow able, through what he or she does inside the prison, through bringing a program like Kairos to a prison, was able to keep one person from ending up after they're released coming back to prison, that more than pays for the chaplain's salary. So
you're saying that there's actually an economic case to be made for this. John, thanks so much for your call.
We're
about to go to break, and I want to get both of you to comment on that when we come out the other side. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a closer look at the increase in prison violence in the Carolinas and around the country. Do you think taking better care of inmates, including offering opportunities for professional and personal development, is a key part of the responsibility of prison systems? Or do you believe this population has forfeited its rights to such perks? When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to reach us on this Wednesday, 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're taking a closer look at the prison system in North Carolina with two people who spent decades working in different prison systems around the country and who now both teach at UNC Pembroke. Mario Paparosi is the chair of and a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. Judy Paparosi works as an adjunct professor in that same department. She is also a lawyer, and they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And before we get to this next email, just before we went to break, we heard from John in Ogden, who was talking about the Kairos ministry and the impact that he felt chaplains had on inmates, and how there's actually an economic argument to be made for keeping chaplains.
Well, there is an economic argument to be made for keeping chaplains, and there's an economic argument made for having more teachers and counselors, etc. And I put chaplains in that same basket. Because they are helping, they're counseling, and they're helping people transition to the community. The Kairos program has great results. The Justice Fellowship program has great results. That we would not spend money in those areas, and I would add counseling, teaching, etc., speaks to what we think a corrections department is supposed to do, which is flawed. I am also concerned that after so many years now of being in this business, I'm still in it, over 40 years, this is not a new discussion to me. What the new director said about having hope and correcting people, my goodness, Judy, how many times have we seen that in our careers, even
times.
Prior to us? And there are examples of people who have said those same things and had great results when they made the changes. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. In the 1940s, there was a warden at San Quentin in California, clearly one of the most notorious prisons in the country. And you can just picture the James Cagney kind of environment in that institution. His name was Warden Duffy, and he was my hero as a kid because I always wanted to work in prisons, as strange as that sounds. But
that does sound really strange, Judy, and I want to ask you about that later.
No, please don't. No. But it was always that was always put on my heart that this is what I was going to do. And Warden Duffy, he put so many rehabilitative programs in a prison in the 1940s before we even talked about rehabilitation. And the inmates would applaud when he'd walk into the mess room. They'd give him a standing ovation because he gave so many inmates so much hope. And so then we went through where there were terrible crimes in the news, like Manson. Now we've got to get tough. So we're driven by the media. And what the media gets out there in how many sound bites it does in a day, then legislatures change their minds. And then we go to the tough part, and then overcrowding, all the other issues come up. So everybody thinks they feel better. And then we go into a rehabilitative period, which is when I started, which luckily I started in the golden age of rehabilitation. But that's now gone to the wayside.
So
the pendulum swung away from rehabilitation.
How do you unplug from that cycle? It sounds like what you're saying, it sounds like you're identifying really the public pressure from crime that then gets put on elected officials,
sure,
or people who are going to have to run for office again in a year and a half. It sounds like those folks really bear the brunt of the responsibility or lack of.
The bureaucrats working in the system, like me and Judy and the new director, have to deal with, you said it before, the legislature. We're really dealing with the public. And it's our job, and we've done a poor job as a profession, frankly, and I'll blame the politicians as well, and I was one of those at one point in my life. But we don't do a good enough job educating the public about what this is all about. For example, how often have you heard, hey, look, 95% of these people are going to come out whether you like it or not. The question is, how do you want them to come out to live among you? We don't have to be always arguing ideologically. Do I want to give a group hug to criminals or do I want to punish criminals? We can all agree we want to be safer. Let's agree with that outcome and work backwards and talk about what will it take to make us safer, even if we don't like some of the things. Maybe you don't like providing an education to an inmate, but you better do it because it speaks to your safety. Maybe you like it, in which case it's more palatable. But the ideology has to be set aside, and we have to focus on what result we want. And I think everybody can agree we want to be safer. And let's work backwards from there.
We have an email from Napier who writes, I'm currently the plaintiff in a lawsuit against the state of North Carolina regarding the lack of ADA accommodations in the judicial system. What is your view on the role of federal laws regarding the mental health of prisoners in the state? What is your view on the punishment of law enforcement who violate the law? Is there too much immunity for a law enforcement officer wrongdoing? And he's attached his lawsuit, which we're not going to be able to read right now, Napier, but may take a look at it later.
Well, first of all, federal law has to be complied with, period. ADA requirements are what they are, and states don't have the option to not comply. Secondly, law enforcement officers don't have immunity. Judges have immunity, but that's about it. And so the reality is that it's mistaken belief if you think that people working in law enforcement have immunity, because they do not.
Well, there was an incredibly in-depth investigation undertaken by the Charlotte Observer, taking a look at the prison system in North Carolina. It found that some officers, and we will include a link to this, I think it was a 5-part investigation. It could have even been more involved than that. But it found that some officers smuggle drugs and cell phones to inmates. Others have sex with them or beat them in areas not monitored by security cameras. Basically found in this investigation a hidden world of drugs, sex, and gang violence that thrives inside the state's prisons, and that officers who are paid to prevent such corruption are instead fueling it. The investigation concludes state leaders created the very conditions that allow corruption to flourish. And of course, this Charlotte Observer investigation led to a study by Duke University about the current state of the prison systems and necessary reforms. So it sounds like even as a corrections officer on that side of it, in the system, you need to find a way to work with the, they found a more profitable way of working with the inmates. Where is this coming from? Why are so many officers vulnerable to this kind of corruption?
It's a minority, frankly, and it's a shame. That's the few bad apples syndrome kind of a thing. Yes, it goes on, and it's been going on for a long, long time, and it should end and not go on. I think if you paid people more money, you'd still have some element of corruption in there. I've seen many I've seen many examples of physical abuse. I've seen many examples of people bringing in contraband that they shouldn't have for inmates, etc. Those are all terrible things. A few years ago, there was that famous case in New York State where the woman working, I think it was in the sewing unit or whatever, helped those two inmates escape by bringing in contraband, etc. It's mistaken, though, to believe that 90% of the corrections officers do that. I mean, if only 5% do it or 2%, that's going to mess the whole system up for everybody else. And so we need to hire the right people. We need to closely monitor. But unfortunately, in life, it's a social fact. Whether it's here at NPR or in a prison, you're going to have people who aren't buying into the company's mission at 100%. That's a reality we have to live with, and we have to be vigilant. But I'll tell you, you cannot be vigilant over those kinds of realities when you have vacancies of 37% in a prison, 25% in a prison. Those are unstaffed posts that make it dangerous in terms of watching the inmates. But who could be watching the guards in that kind of a scenario as well to make sure that we have proper supervision, proper employee evaluations, all the kinds of things that would make the system the kind of system you'd want to pay for with your tax dollars.
And I would just like to add one thing, if that's
okay,
Rachel.
Yes.
I worked in many different prisons, about 4 or 5 long term. And what I found is that I met one corrections officer in all those years who was not a nice guy. One. And I'm talking about probably thousands of corrections officers. But when you're not trained properly from the beginning, an inmate will set you up for that first mistake. So can you take this letter out to my mother? Please, I just don't have a stamp, whatever. So the officer takes the letter out to the mother, and actually there's LSD inside, and it's not really to the mother, it's to somebody else. And the inmate has now set that officer up for failure. And so he bribes, basically he has him, he's bribing him, he's going to use that officer to manipulate, to bring the drugs in for the rest of that officer's career. Very rarely have we heard these stories about it, officers having sex. You see it on like Law and Order and so forth. But honestly, I didn't spend a lot of time in women's prisons, although I did a little bit. But in the men's prisons, they're so stretched that I doubt these kind of problems can be fixed easily, and they should not get the attention even of this show, because they're really in the minority, as Mario started out to say, these kind of having sex with inmates and so forth. It's really a minority, but I would go back to the way we screen these people, the way that they come in, the attitude, and who we're hiring. Is he going to be a correctional officer? Is it going to be somebody who's going to come in and just be a Hitler in a prison? And that is easy to fall into.
Lisa from Atkinson called. She said, I retired from the Department of Corrections in March, spent 20 years in the system. The gigantic problem is the gang factor. The younger inmates have to prove themselves. And the way to do this is to hurt a correctional officer. And this is something that we've heard in looking at all of these different analyses of state prison systems, is that there is an increase in gangs. You even said that earlier in this discussion, Mario. How do you deal with that?
That's very difficult, by the way. But systems that have done effective jobs in managing gangs have set up gang units where they'll very comprehensively screen each inmate and segregate the gangs and maybe put them into special gang counseling type programs and so on. It's no different, by the way, than on the street, because to be in a gang on the street, very often they have to kill some innocent person in order to gain membership in the gang. So in the prison, that's their world. The corrections officer becomes the target.
Right.
This is a serious problem, and they cannot be commingled without great, great danger. So I think the screening for gangs has to be very, very comprehensive and really paid attention to closely. And get those people separate, and then try to do whatever you can in terms of gang counseling and so on to get people out. Very, very tough problem, whether you're locked up or whether you're not.
Daniel from Wilmington called, said he saw a documentary recently showing Scandinavian prisoners living on an island. Each prisoner had a role on the island. It forced them to integrate back into society. Goes along with what the guests are saying. These people should have something to look forward to or have a purpose. I think I even know the documentary Daniel's talking about, and I can't remember the country, but it was almost camp-like. They were lovely accommodations. There was a lot of trust put with inmates. Any comment on that?
Well, of course, it all depends on the inmate. The screening that would go into that, you'd want an inmate who's probably minimum security, doesn't have a lot of time left, is working off his time through this kind of program. I mean, these things can work. We have firefighters in California who are inmates. We've just heard a lot about the positive program of training, having dog trainers go in and work with these inmates. So those inmates would probably be great for it. It just really depends on the kind of inmate. Usually the short-termers will do very well at a program like that, but I'd like to consider going on an island.
And we have Alex from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. You work in the New Hanover County Jail.
I used to work in the New Hanover County Jail. I was an instructor, and I trained some of the newer recruits and hirings, people freshly hired in the housing units. And we would go through practical scenarios about, as one of the other guests said, about the inmates trying to set them up and get them on the hook for one or two things, and then learning how to manipulate that officer from there. I did want to say, though, however, there's a call in the air about 6 minutes ago, 7 minutes ago, about a gentleman who was arguing for salaried positions with chaplains.
Yes.
And as a taxpayer, I just wanted to say that if you wanted to invest in their education or get these people into more constructive tradesmen programs or help them get their GED, I'm all about it. But as somebody who believes in the separation of church and state, I'm not comfortable paying for any type of religious discussions or any kind of programs that go on in the jail.
So,
in an effort to quote
Alex, you don't take issue with enrichment or improvement opportunities for the inmates. You just
absolutely not.
Don't want
the,
public
the
money.
Side of it.
Right. You don't want public money to be used for particular religious approaches. Okay.
That's kind of where I draw the line, but I just wanted to say that was my comment. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you so much for your call, Alex. And we are getting close. We had a call from Jeffrey from Pender Correctional. He says this was a much-needed conversation. He wrote a UNC Chapel Hill article. He spent 31 years in prison. We'll look for that article. And John, also in Pender Correctional, says he was beaten by the officers. They assaulted him. He talked to the Charlotte Observer about what happened to him. It sounds, according to the Charlotte Observer investigation, that it's not this tiny minority of officers, that there is this climate of corruption in the prison system.
I would take issue with that. I don't think there's a climate of corruption. I think if you have 10% of the officers doing those kinds of things and the media gets a hold of that and doesn't talk about the 90% of the other things that are going on, we get a skewed impression. Believe me, I'm not sitting here telling you that there's not abuse and there are not inappropriate things going on, because there are. And I've seen it, as I said, myself over the years. But that can't be corrected to the extent we would like it to be corrected with the understaffing that we have. Because while we're talking about understaffing, we're talking about inmates to corrections officers. Well, that also applies to supervision and administration. There's just not enough attention paid to managing prisons, frankly, I believe, because inmates have no voice. They're not valued in our society. And so you have many people in the public, I'm sorry to say, who will say, you know, who cares what they really need or want? They did a bad thing, et cetera. Now, that's the gene pool of people we pick to work in corrections or in policing or in prosecution or wherever. We are part of our society. We need to be really clear about the values that you should have and the skill set that you should have. And I think there needs to be a total upgrading so we can actually do corrections, which includes, as I said, punishment, incapacitation, rehabilitation, or all of the above, justice as well. But it doesn't only produce a punishment piece, because if you doubled or tripled the number of corrections officers in order to just contain people, well, I guess you'd be ruling by brute force and you'd have containment. That doesn't accomplish anything.
And on that note, that's this edition of Coastline. Mario and Judy Paparosi, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.